Thank you so much for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 Viroqua. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fantastic.
Good. Okay, so this is number 16 in your 16. Long list of
how many,
obstacles to cure.
How many are there?
I mean,
okay, so
limitless.
I had this there. I started this doing this, you know, monthly thing at the Commons. I said, well, I'll do it for a year. And then I talked to, you know, Clay there, and he said, well, do you want to keep doing it? What's the deal? I'm like, oh, well, I got to think about that. And I said, okay, I'll come up with a list. So I just generated my list of different obstacles.
Right.
I think I'm at about 46 right now.
Oh, my gosh. That's
so
it.
So it's overwhelming, yeah?
But,
you know, there's a lot of overlap between these.
Right.
And so there's some of these we talk about, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's kind of repetition, right? So could I, like, distill it down to seven, right? That's the idea of then you've got the seven obstacles to cure, or the 13, right?
Oh,
it's
got
to be it's got to be a prime number. 19.
Oh, is that what they do?
I don't know.
I mean,
I've always been...
Because, of course, you have your even-numbered lists, like, yes. You know, the top 10, but...
Well, it's three, right? When you have a bullet points, there's three bullet points.
Always, yes.
The hamburger that we talked about, right? The three things that you got to do when you
right.
respond to somebody, right?
Oh, yeah, right. Positive, negative, positive.
But three.
Yeah.
Maybe five. But four, do you see? I mean, not that I don't use four in a PowerPoint presentation, but generally it's like, I need three. Like, two is not
at
enough.
At least three, right.
All right, well, anyway, so then maybe there's 46. I don't know. I come up with more.
So we're talking about clean labels today.
Clean labels, yes.
Whatever that means.
What does that mean? Clean label.
Well,
first of all, maybe the label's a problem to begin with, right? Why do we buy food with a label on it? In 1869, did we buy food? Remember my rule of 1869.
Right.
Did we buy food with labels on it in 1869? I'm sure we did, but I don't know.
If
you went to the store, right, the general store, I mean, again, I think like Little House on the Prairie. You go
no.
to the general store, it was like bulk bins.
Yeah, they
right?
were in sacks, if anything, right? You could buy a sack of flour.
And he's weighing it, right? He or she, right? They're weighing it and then going on weight.
Right.
I don't know.
Labels. I mean, wasn't everything just what it was?
Yeah.
Right? When you bought lard, it was lard. When you bought sugar, when you bought flour, it was one ingredient foodstuffs.
Right. And flour, we didn't have like six different kinds of flour. It was just a flour that's at the store. Or maybe I make my own flour and I buy it from the store because they've already milled it and I don't have to mill it or, you know, I don't know.
Right.
Sugar. I mean, we'd buy sugar. But again, if we had honey or we had maple syrup, then we would just use what we had.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a direct translation, like, is this the same amount? Or why would I use refined sugar when I can use honey? Or maybe I want refined sugar, it's better, and I buy some candy? Or I don't know.
So this goes back to just the fractionization of food.
Yeah.
I mean, when we started to decide that we were going to take things out of food and add things to food... I mean, part of it was preservation, right?
Yes.
I mean, of course, the first thing we did was can. And so...
Yeah, well, even just using salt. So
right.
salt would be
okay.
the first thing, right? We would salt.
Right.
There's a great book on... It's called Cod, which is just talking about how the cod fishery on the North Atlantic coast on the United States, Canada, was basically the protein store for Europe. So that population growth in Europe was kind of dependent upon... using those fisheries, right? Because cod, they would come and catch cod, right? So they just, you know, travel across the ocean, which I don't think is that far on the north side.
Right.
But they would, they would catch cod and then they would preserve it. And so they got to preserve it and bring it back to Europe so there's a protein source that they could share with others.
And therefore salt.
And therefore salt, because salt was a way that we could preserve it.
Right.
So salted fish.
Okay.
Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? We're supporting population growth, right? If we didn't have that, maybe the population wouldn't grow as much.
And you still wouldn't need a label because salt is salt.
Yeah, right.
So
or we wouldn't ask him, oh, you know, what's the quality of the salt that you use, right? Versus like, I'm thankful that there's some salted fish that I can buy.
Right.
And probably that wasn't high on the list, right? That wasn't the thing that we wanted to eat, but it would be something that was still available.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Who knows?
Yeah. So then you had canning.
Yeah, canning.
And canning was very simple. That was with a vinegar or a salt base.
Yeah, when did canning start in the United States? I mean, again, they were canning fish. I think that was the first piece.
Sure. And then vegetables to make the harvest last longer in colder climates.
I mean, this is the Native Americans would have been doing that, right? Drying out squash or I don't know, right? Making pemmican, drying foods, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be sunlight. Mm-hmm. That would be even perhaps before salt.
Right. Oh, definitely. Yes.
Because
we're highly any apparatus for it.
We're motivated as humans to make sure that we've got food in March.
Right. Right.
And what do we need to do to make sure we have food in March?
Find some way to preserve it.
Right.
So,
but now we're preserving
unnecessarily, yes. Right.
And rice crackers and yes. All sorts of other things that you're like, wow, do I really want to preserve that?
Right. And when we would can, we would do it with simple ingredients again, like salt and vinegar, knowing that it wouldn't last more than a year or two, right? I mean, it can surprisingly last, you know, several years, but we weren't adding weird things to make it last a really long time for that quote-unquote shelf life that we have now.
And the food industry's highly motivated on that, right?
Right.
I mean, look at the grocery store. They don't, I mean, I'm speaking maybe, but that I don't think they make most of their income on the fresh fruits and vegetables they
sell.
That's
what they say. It's the middle aisles.
It's the middle of the aisle, right? So then you know the whole saying, don't shop the middle of the store, shop the perimeter.
Right. The stuff that spoils. That's the meat, that the spoils. Milk, the eggs, the cheese,
because that's
the
where
produce.
The freezers are because they have to plug them in.
Right.
But I guess you go to grocery stores now and they've got the big freezers in the middle of the store.
Right. But those are the more packaged foods.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true.
That's like the French fries and the burritos.
That's true. So again, shop the perimeter.
Yeah.
Stay away from labels. But if you're going to buy a food with a label, then we want a clean label. Is that right? So what does that mean?
Transparency.
And where does it come from? Yeah, transparency.
Question mark?
So I would say that's a consumer-oriented thing, right?
Yes.
Because we want to know what's in our food. Michael Pollan talked about this, right, in his nutrition in defense of food about, you know, searching for foods that have less than five ingredients,
mm-hmm.
that have ingredients that you can pronounce.
Yeah.
Right?
Ingredients these are the that things. Are their own single part as well.
Exactly. And I mean, that feeds, you know, that certainly resonates with us. Like if you're packaging food and I don't necessarily trust you, at least put on the label what you're doing. We're going to hold you. It's transparent so that we know what we're consuming here.
Right.
So let's do that. So that I think it was really put forward by a consumer movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we could go way back and look at Pure Food and Drug Act, I think, in the early 1900s. You remember...
The early 1900s? No, I don't remember, but thank you for asking.
Okay.
I won't take that as an insult.
Yeah. So you remember The Jungle by Upton Sinclair? Did you ever read The Jungle?
I didn't read it, but I know of it.
It's kind of a socialist communist manifesto at the end, but the beginning was like this, you know, critique of the meatpacking industry. In Chicago.
Okay.
You probably know some of this, but so that you know the meatpacking industry in Chicago and, you know, migrant workers would come there, immigrants would come there and work there. And there's stories of people losing fingers and it gets mixed up in the sausage, right? And
right.
All the terrible work conditions and this kind of thing. But anyways, that kind of set forth this movement under the early 1900s or the progressive movement, right? That's when Teddy Roosevelt was president. And mm-hmm. So there were changes that were made, right? So in, you know, kind of empower the... I'm not sure the consumer, but let's just say we want to take care of the middle class, perhaps. So they passed the Clean Food and Drug or Pure Food and Drug Act, which was trying to clean that up to say, here's standards that have to be met by the food industry. There was also a big deal in the patent medicine industry, right? So patent medicines were a huge deal in the 1700s, 1800s, that people would like sell their wares, right? Basically, supplements, maybe? I don't know. I mean, I use supplements, right? But patent medicines would be like liver tonic or something, right?
Right.
Or bile pills or something like this. And they were sold and they were highly advertised and people would buy them, right? They were medicinals, right? Medicines that you would buy over the counter. But that was there was a lot of muckraking going on and kind of exposing that industry. And that's part of that Food and Drug Act or Pure Food, or I can't remember exactly what it was. But in the end, it was to try to protect the consumers, but it didn't really necessarily do it. It didn't put these companies out of business. It just changed the way in which they had to engage. right? So again, we pass a law, we're doing something to say we need to protect the consumers, but then who's trying to find the loopholes to say, hey, we can kind of get around that?
Right. And the industries that are affected by these laws, obviously, are trying to find workarounds.
And I think that's what's happened with a clean label, or that's my best take on that, right? So we as consumers are demanding and say, hey, we want to know. We deserve to know what's on the label. And this is a relatively new trend, but let's say, you know, 15, 20 years, it's not brand new to really hold the food industry accountable and say, tell me what's in it.
Right.
And I think that's a good thing, but now it's turned into, well, how does the food industry still do what they want to do and really not be completely honest? But what is honesty, right? Honesty is like, okay, well, it has natural flavorings in it.
Right.
What is natural flavorings?
Well, you know, yeah. Tell us about how they find the natural flavorings.
Well, okay. So I'll just give an example with patients. I think I said this before. I in my career, I've seen three patients that have taken LaCroix water out of their diet and their headaches disappear.
Whoa.
So three times it's happened, right? And one patient was interesting. We had done all these things, did detox, did elimination diet. She still got headaches. And I don't even know how it came up because it wasn't for me. She somehow did that and she took out the, and you know, it was like, well, I'm drinking LaCroix water all the time and I do more of it when I'm kind of detoxing, right? Because that's my little special treat and I get fizzy water and this kind of thing. And she took it out and her headaches disappeared.
Whoa.
I'm like, oh my gosh. She's like, what's in the LaCroix? Carbonated water, natural flavorings. And call LaCroix and ask them, hey, what's in the natural flavorings? They aren't going to tell you. They're not. They don't have to,
right?
And there's all sorts of urban myths or what's in the natural flavoring. Just saying that we see natural flavoring, we think that hey, that's okay,
right?
It's all right.
Yeah, because of the word natural.
Yeah, and no. So that's just a primary example of the use of all these foods, these additives and preservatives that we add to our food chain. I mean, in the United States, I think there's over 2,000 different items.
It's unbelievable.
And they have what's called GRAS status, right? GRAS, G-R-A-S, which means generally recognized as safe.
Which doesn't mean...
It doesn't mean it's
that
safe.
That we know, right?
So
yeah.
Again, what would I say? That the precautionary principle is evidence of no harm is not the same as no evidence of harm.
Right.
Right. So is that right?
I think the other way around. No evidence of harm is not the same thing as evidence of no harm.
Right. So we say, oh, well, we've never seen any problems with that. That doesn't mean that there's not problems. And what problems are we looking for? And how do we know this? And is it a...
And how long does it take to manifest?
Exactly.
That's, I mean, these new products on the line, we don't know what they're doing.
How long does it take to poison yourself with something? Again, poison. Some people are going to be able to tolerate these. Some people aren't.
Right.
And again, does it happen overnight? I mean... I certainly have seen people with red number two when they take it out and things change
quickly.
Other people, they do it and nothing happens. So it's like, how sensitive are you to this versus we're going to, again, make a public health declaration, right, that we're just doing this instead of the individual approach, right, the N of one that I talk about, instead of the N of 350 million. But again, the clean label is, hey, we're trying to protect the 350 million that we want to hold the food industry responsible, and you need to put on the label what you're using. And so they use natural flavorings. But then, what exactly is that? Like, what exact chemical that falls under the definition of natural flavoring that allows you to use that?
Right.
That
you
the
said,
Food and Drug Administration
you said it's some kind
are
used of gas? Gas process?
Well, that's, for flavorings.
Oh,
so that's
artificial
gas chromatology.
But that's artificial.
Artificial, flavorings. But could we maybe do that and have it natural? And what is natural versus artificial? Artificial means maybe we created the whole molecule in the lab versus we used a natural substrate and then changed it a little bit and processed it. Or, I mean, this is all Frankenfood stuff, yes?
Yeah.
And again, but we have 2,000 plus different things that we add to the food chain that are not about nutritional value, right? They have nothing to do with energy. They don't have anything to do with nutrients, right? I mean, there's things on labels if you put supplements in there that's listed on there, but let's just say that's not a GRAS status, right? But all these other things, and a laundry list goes on and on and on. And are we really clear that it's in there? Like, we want to know if this has an additive or preservative in it.
Right, right.
But then we get into the whole, you know, what are some of these things?
Yeah, which what do they really mean when they say?
Yeah.
That so, it's this.
So again, I think that there's this with the label, there's this, I call it the measurement fallacy. I don't even know if that exists. Maybe I made, well, I did make it up. But the measurement fallacy is that we can measure it, then it exists. If we can't measure it, it doesn't exist.
Okay.
And so we can take a food and we can say, well, okay, how many calories are in this? And the calories we can more or less predict. We can get
saying.
A bomb calorimeter and kind of oxidize the food and measure the heat from that. Or I think calories changing the temperature of water 1 centigrade or something, or I mean, whatever that definition is. So we can do that. We can do it in a lab and we say, oh, well, this is the calorie content. Understand, calories is that you eating the same amount of calories, is that the same as me eating the same amount of calories? Do we all work like bomb calorimeters? Does my metabolism, the way that I oxidize foods, exactly the same as yours?
Right.
I'm going to argue no. I think they're similar, but maybe not identical. But we got to start somewhere, right? So we can measure the calories based on the bomb calorimeter. That's the definition. It's not like, hey, I'm going to eat this food and I'm going to measure how much heat I produce in my body if I don't move. And we could do that. Or you can do this where you really try to tell somebody's energy expenditure by putting them in a suit. Or I think of the Dune movie, right? The Dune movie where they're recycling the water.
Yeah.
Right? Did you see that? Right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to lose any of the water. But they do something like that where they're able to... calculate the energy expenditure, but that's a lab thing, right? But anyways, that's calories, fat, carbohydrates. There's ways that we can analyze that and determine, oh, this is how much fat, this is how much calorie, this is how much carbohydrates in it, this is how much fiber. So we can do the measurement of that, and we put that on a label.
Right.
And then we judge the food based on that. And we say, oh, it's got a lot of fiber in it. But then we get into, well, is it, you know... Is it the kind of fiber? Does that make a difference? Or is it net fiber, right? So people that are keto, they'll be like, oh, my net carbs are low, right? Versus, oh, yeah, well, some of those carbs were fiber, so you don't count them? They don't count as a carb? Well, yeah, because you don't digest them, you don't use them. Okay,
oh,
that's
wow.
Still a generalization, but you're like, oh, my net carb content is low. And they'll put that on like keto bars too, right? Net carbs. So they'll list the net carbs.
Oh, that's where the net 10 comes from.
That's where the net,
that.
Exactly. Okay. So they're trying to say, hey, there may be 15 carbs in here, but only 3 of them are net carbs because 12 of them are fiber.
Wow.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe, but that's still just a use of the industry or the keto companies to say, hey, we need to market a product and we can't market a keto product that has 20 grams of carbohydrate in it.
And so getting back to the measurement fallacy, you can't measure the artificial or natural flavors. I mean, is that part of where you're going?
Well, sort of.
That they don't
but
count because they're not measurable?
Well, somewhat. So we do, because it's not considered a label claim, right? A label claim is going to be by law, we have to list these things on the label. Artificial flavorings, we don't have to put how much of it is in there. But you can tell based on where it is on the ingredient list.
Right.
If it's first on the ingredient list, that means
there's
that's the bulk versus if it's last. But still, you're like, oh, it's last on the ingredient list. Not a problem. I don't know. But again, we're not really perhaps measuring how this food makes me feel, right? So I've talked about kind of this, is the food hyper-craveable? Is it hyper-palatable, right? How processed is it, right? We talk about ultra-refined foods versus refined foods or ultra-processed. Like, what's that mean? Like, how am I going to look at a label and know that it's ultra-processed versus just kind of processed?
And why do you want to know that? Because you don't want ultra-processed versus processed? Aren't they both kind of in the same camp of being, again, just not a natural food?
Sure. You just say processed, no, but that would be maybe label, no. But, you know, is there some foods that are processed more than others? And is that more of a problem? So, for example, if you're using refined vegetable oils versus using extra virgin olive oil in
okay.
it. Right, yeah. So is extra virgin olive oil considered processed? It's really not. It's unrefined. But again, right, the chips that I eat, right, I'm looking for them, right, chips, and they're not healthy, right? They got a label on them, the gluten-free ones. But they do have olive oil in them, but it's not extra virgin olive oil.
Oh,
but it's
okay.
olive oil, right?
Yeah.
But still, I still don't know, did they bake it? Did they fry it? How did they process this? How did they put those ingredients together? How long did they do it? How long did they heat it? Right, because those are all things that make a difference in the end quality product.
Yeah.
But we don't know that, right? That's not going to appear on a label.
No.
And they're not going to tell you, wow, if you eat this food, you may 10 minutes later want to eat it again, right? This is a hyper-craveable food, right? We don't know. We can't tell taste from a label. That's not on a label. And how many foods do we buy? Like, we've never had a food before, and we decide, hey, I'm going to try this, like, blindly. Like, you just pick something and say, oh, wow, this looks good because of the color or because of what it is, you know, what, you know, some new, I don't know, dried beets. I don't know.
Or cauliflower pizza.
Cauliflower
crust.
Pizza, right? You're like, oh, wow, this fits. This is something that I'm looking for. I'm gluten-free, and so I'm going to do this, right? And you read the label, and you're like, oh, it seems clean, or there's six things on there. Oh, but that's okay because it's gluten-free, and I can do this as a pizza crust versus me making my own pizza crust.
Right, and knowing exactly what the process was and exactly what the ingredients are.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to jump in and thank you for listening to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 in Viroqua. I want to remind you that the Skeptical Naturopath, Paul Rattay, will be giving his 17th lecture on Saturday, May 11th from 9 to 10 in the morning at the Commons on Jefferson Street with a free will donation. And the topic is choice. The paradox of choice. Does it lead to more freedom?
Ooh, wow, don't know. Wait till next month. We'll talk about that next month.
Right?
Choice that goes along with us. Maybe we choose not to buy something with a label on it.
Right.
Anyway, so there's that kind of the technical part of label, right? We learn how to read labels. Now there's the front of the label, there's the back of the label, right? And the front of the label is where you put label claims, health claims.
Organic.
And
all natural.
And the FDA and the USDA is really particular if you're going to put a health claim on a label, right? That health claim needs to be, like, you can't make claims that haven't been, you know, adopted or you know, I don't know that it's adopted, but you're making health claims that there's some evidence
proven,
to support that.
Yeah, some sort of proven claim.
Yeah, so they'll definitely bust supplement companies and food industry that they're putting things on their label they shouldn't.
Okay, but that's not the organic, natural, free from fats or something like that. I mean,
no, that's not. But
right. You
can put organic on it, right? But organic means, hey, I've been certified and this is something
right.
that I've been through. I can use organic. And it does mean something. Natural, what does natural mean?
Right.
And there's no definition of natural.
Yeah.
Free from, right? So it doesn't have any of this in there. Okay, well, it's free from, you know, sugar, or it's kind of funny, right? I mean, you hear when you see, maybe iced tea is an example, right? So if I buy tea, I mean, I make my own, but if I'm buying it, you know, I buy deliberately unsweetened. But unsweetened, they could put low sugar on it, right? Or they could say no sugar, but they don't put that on unsweetened. But then they have the other brand of iced tea that says low sugar or zero sugar. I'm like, wow, why wouldn't they put zero sugar on the unsweetened one? No, zero sugar means that it's sweet, but there's no sugar in it.
There's something else in it.
Ah, there's an artificial sweetener in that. So I already know by just looking at that label that if it says zero sugar, that I know that it's sweet.
Whereas
unsweetened,
else.
Yeah. I know there's going to be no sweetness to it.
Wow.
Right? And I just know that. And again, you can look at the back of the label mm-hmm. and then look at that and say, oh, yeah, there's acesulfame potassium, there's artificial flavor, you know, there's artificial sweeteners in there. We could see that. And the thing with artificial sweeteners, they're actually on the label, right? And I mean, we've become accustomed to seeing those
right.
words on there, like acesulfame potassium, right? We know, or for the most part, that's a sweetener. That's an artificial sweetener.
Acesulfame
potassium?
I don't think I knew that was a sugar,
oh,
actually.
Yeah,
and I've never seen it on any labels that I'm looking at.
Oh, look. If you look in like Diet Coke or, you know.
Oh, well, that's why.
You don't look at those things. You'll see it in other things, too. But okay. Anything sweet, you start looking at that, you're going to be able to pick out. They'll put stevia in it. They'll put acesulfame potassium. They'll use saccharin. They'll use, you know, what am I missing there? NutraSweet, but.
Yeah.
Aspartame, right?
Aspartame, that's what
so those things are on the label. You can see that, and it's pretty clear, right? I mean, the food industry is being up front about those things. Like, they aren't hiding that. It's just that, do you know that acesulfame potassium is a sweetener?
Right.
And they mix the sweeteners because one artificial sweetener by itself doesn't work very well, right? There may be a bitter aftertaste to it, so they want to put something in that to kind of balance that a little bit.
Amazing.
I mean, food industry is really... really good with this.
Talk to us about the artificial fats. Now, these are interesting. I don't know these names.
Yeah, and if you knew those names,
I'd
maybe
never
you would run,
buy them.
Yes. So here's where clean label goes bad, right?
Right,
so
right.
Clean label is certainly the idea that we want disclosure, right? We want transparency. But now we get into these different things that the food industry uses, their additives and preservatives in order to accomplish certain things in their foods, right? So here's the list, right? So if they want to get a creamy taste, right? So the creamy taste is what they're looking for. They'll use Simplesse. Now, Simplesse, I remember that there's been foods that they used to use that as a marketing tool. They would say it's made with Simplesse.
Right. It's out now, right? It's gone out of fashion. Otherwise,
I guess, yeah. But I don't see it on any labels now. I don't really buy things that I would see that, but maybe I need to look for that. But Simplesse is a trademark product, right? It's a product that the food industry has designed, right? And they don't put Simplesse on the label. What do they put on the label? Well, what it is microparticulated whey protein concentrate. That's what it is. So they microparticulate it. But on the label, you won't see Simplesse. You'll see milk protein.
That's unbelievable.
Or you'll see whey protein concentrate. And you say milk protein, you're like, what do you think when you see milk protein?
I think that they simply just extracted a little bit from wonderful cow's milk. And I feel safe and held. And I'm going to buy this product.
Yeah, I think that's wrong. I mean, so what is it that they did, and how did they process it?
Yeah, clearly, if they've microparticulated it, they're not just extracting it from the milk.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
No,
right. Anyways, but you—that's what you see on the label: milk protein. I can pronounce milk protein.
I know.
It's not unpronounceable. I kind of know what that is, but if isn't milk protein just milk? Like, why would they put milk protein? Because they had to isolate the protein from the milk. So already now they're frankenfooding it, right? They're isolating and manipulating and doing things and processing and heating or whatever they do to produce that. And then would you eat that if it had Simplesse on the label versus milk protein?
Oh my gosh, never.
But it's derived from milk protein. So they're not lying to you. They're just not using the trademark name of the product that they use.
Well, and they're not really... I mean, just saying milk protein doesn't say that they've microparticulated it or that it came from, or that they've concentrated it, right? It's not just microparticulated, it's also concentrated.
Yeah, right.
So what the heck?
And what would we do with that? We see milk protein. You're going to Google it, right? Just Google milk protein and what are you going to get? I'm going to bet you don't come up with Simplesse on there. I mean, maybe it's on there somewhere, but they're not saying, hey, this is a hidden thing. Milk protein, okay, well, it's derived from milk and here's the ways that you can do that. But it could encompass many different things.
No, I've found when you Google these kinds of things, they give you the wiki page that tells you the scientific compounds.
Correct.
And that's, obviously a red herring.
Yeah.
It's like, do you understand all that? No.
But anyway, so milk protein means it's not milk.
Right.
At the very least.
It's not milk.
It's not milk.
Right.
Whey protein concentrate, it's not whey. They used whey as a substrate of which to do other things to it.
Right.
All right. Well, so that's a creamy taste. So if you've got something that's lower fat and you want the creamy taste.
Like a salad dressing,
exactly,
a low-fat salad dressing.
Right, or ice cream, something like that, right? So milk protein. Wow, why don't you just use cream?
Right.
Just give me cream.
Right.
Cream's more expensive than milk protein.
Which is ironic because you don't have to do anything to it.
Yeah, but it's just...
Right? I'm just saying.
Well, right. And it rots and it goes bad. And Simplesse probably sits on the shelf in the food industry
world forever.
It doesn't go away, right? All right. So that's creamy taste. Bulking agents would include things like crystalline, laurolite, D-lite, all in capital letters. And I don't know if these are all United States, right? I'm kind of maybe mixing things that maybe some of these are in Canada as well. But this is just kind
probably
of part of the laundry list.
Probably for the most
part,
though. If you can find it somewhere else, you can find it
in the
States.
United States. Thickeners would be Slended.
Slended, which is interesting because it sounds like slender, and yet it's a thickener.
And it's a thickener. Well, it's going to make you slender when you eat that.
Right, because it's not a real thickener, like gravy.
No calories, right? Calorie-free.
Right.
A thickener that, mouthfeel and flow, this is a huge deal, right? Because, again, when we're using fat replacers, fat is more of a weight thing than it is a taste, right? If you think about that, it's the weight in your mouth. And again, it's trying to mimic that. We want that certain mouthfeel, right? So those would be things like Avicel, Methocel, Socafloc.
Jeez.
Cream 5 or 7,000, my favorite, right?
God, that's like a movie.
Yeah, Genugel, right? So those are some examples of mouthfeel. So cream 5 or 7,000, how's that listed on the label?
Citrus fiber.
Citrus fiber. So you see citrus fiber in a label. What do you say? We already talked about this.
Yeah, yeah. You've extracted the lovely, pithy, you know, skin of the lemon, you know? I mean, I picture this beautiful lemon orchard where they're pulling all the skins off the lemons. And of course, they're using the juice in something else. And they're just using that as a fibrous addition. Because of course, when I've made desserts, I've done that as well, where you have to, you know, take some of the skin of the citrus. It's unbelievable that they put citrus fiber down. That's so misleading.
Right? Citrus fiber. So it's derived from citrus fiber.
Right.
So citrus fiber is the base.
It might have started as that, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. But they've now manipulated it, and you don't know how much they've manipulated it. And again, at least if you know Cream Fiber 7000, do a search on Cream Fiber 7000 now. We're being specific.
Right.
And we can say, what is it? Where is it? How is it made? You know, I want to know these things.
You just said, I don't know what they've done to it or how many things they've added to it. But with a number like 7000, it can't be good.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's...
it's not like Cream Fiber 3. Jeez.
It does sound like a movie, doesn't
it? It does. It sounds like, yeah, Mystery Science Theater 3000.
And would you eat that? Would you, if you looked at a label and you see Cream Fiber 7000, I think the warning signs would go up and say, whoa.
I mean, even the first two sound like medicines, Avicel, Methicel.
I don't know what those mean.
Well, think about it, though. Methicel, that's probably a minty flavor.
Yes.
That's, oh, no, because this is artificial fats.
Yeah, so, meth the cell. So, yeah, meth, I don't know what the meth, what's in.
That's weird. Yeah. And then carrageenan, I know this from macrobiotics. That's actually a seaweed.
Yeah, and actually carrageenan in and of itself, if you're just eating the seaweed, may not be a problem.
No.
But they take that carrageenan and turn it into other things. So Genugel is an example of
something's been
derived
added,
from
carrageenan. Yeah, or added to the carrageenan.
People with IBS, they'll tell you, hey, I got to stay away from carrageenan, right? And that's certainly on the list to say, whoa, this is a problem for me.
Right.
But again, then is citrus fiber a problem? And is milk protein a problem? Right, where we've got these hidden food items that we don't know, but they sound good, right? And that's the food industry now responding to our, let's say, demand as consumers to say, hey, we want transparency. Tell us what you're putting it. And the food industry is like, okay, well, how are we going to do this? And how do we
telling a story. It's just like anything else in the marketing realm of food products. They're telling you a story because, like I said, it's interesting. I have pictures of what I imagine, you know, happy cows, whey protein, happy lemon orchard, citrus fiber. They're telling me a story, and they're using words that they know that people are going to associate with one ingredient foodstuffs.
Right, that's I talked about that, the optimism bias. And here, I'll read it because I can't remember it off the top of my head. Right? We have notes. Food ingredient perceived as positive can lead to an exaggerated positive assessment of the food as a whole. Right, so one item, if it's a strong enough item and you're really, you know, that's something that's really important, you're like, I'll ignore all the other things. And that's the opposite of the negative bias, which says one negative product may also flavor, you know, color your perception of it and say that's a bad product. And you're just doing it on one thing by itself.
Yeah.
So, again, what am I looking for? What am I looking for on a label? Am I trying to stay away from things? Am I looking for not many ingredients? Am I looking for things that are pronounceable, right? Because it's checking off on Michael Pollan's list.
Right.
I mean, you can pronounce it. Citrus fiber, I mean, I have an image of what that is. Unfortunately, that's not what it really is. Mm. So good, bad, is this clean label gone bad, right? I'm not sure.
It's
an adaptation, right? It's the food industry being able to adapt to what the consumer trends are.
Right.
And that's what they're good at, right?
Right. I mean, the end result would be that they wouldn't have as many sales if they were completely open and honest with Crystalline, Simpless, and Genugel. So, I mean, I think we can also say that it's a workaround.
Yeah, it's a workaround.
Yeah.
It is what it is, right? We're in a capitalistic country, and this is the driving force, right? It's profit. Profit certainly over health. If health helps me sell foods, I'll certainly use health to sell a food.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the trend right now. If it wasn't the trend, they would tell us some other story, but that's what we want right now.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's the narrative, right?
Right.
Okay, so then there's maltodextrin, too. And maltodextrin is listed as maltodextrin. But again, what's behind it, right? It's considered the miracle starch, right? Adds body to fruit juice. It's a powdery base for potato chip seasoning. It's a fat replacer in dressings and spreads. So they use it and they label it.
Yeah,
but again,
do.
What's it derived from, right? Is it corn? I mean, oftentimes if it's corn or whatever, you just make the assumption like, wow, I could get gluten because I'm eating maltodextrin. That doesn't mean that it's not necessarily not wheat starch.
Right, right.
Because they're not telling me what it's derived from, but it's starch and they're using it for all these different things. But again, at least it appears that way. Where's Cream Fiber 7000? Nope, you won't see that on any label.
Right.
All right, well, so those are artificial fats, right? So then there's also artificial flavorings. I kind of mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
Versus natural flavorings, right? So artificial flavoring means that we use gas chromatography, right? This all chemistry stuff to isolate the flavor components, and then we can say, oh, we can extract that, right? Or we can manipulate that, or we can make that.
Yeah, mimic it.
We can mimic it, and then we put it in there. And we were talking about strawberry flavoring.
Yes, that's the one that seems to be the most off the charts, where you just know that it's not real. Anything strawberry flavored, especially if it says artificially flavored, but even naturally flavored strawberry, it just, you know, if your palate is trained to eat strawberries in season, you'll know that that isn't what strawberries taste like.
Yeah, right. It's that scratch and sniff thing, right? We got to come back to the scratch and sniff. Like, those went out of style.
And you can find them, though.
Can you still find
yes,
them?
Yes, you can buy them on Amazon, I hate to say, but yes.
I wonder that that's what the food... I wonder if those are, like... things produced by the food industry, right? Or maybe that's what we should do on labels
they
is you put the scratch and sniff, so at least you have to smell what's in it.
Right.
That would be better.
Remember the pizza one?
Oh, the pizza
one. It was
one.
So good.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so this is... but let's talk about strawberries for a second. And think about strawberries. Like, when you eat a strawberry... So this is going to come to the... spend a moment on hyper-cravable versus hyper-palatable. So eating fruit... And think about it. When I eat a strawberry, what happens when you eat an unripe strawberry?
Ugh, it's awful.
Yeah, it's hard. It's not soft. What happens when you eat a rotten strawberry? It's a little too sweet. Now it's too soft.
Yeah.
So there's that sweet spot that we're looking for.
Right.
Yes?
Right.
And when you buy the strawberry, do you know that?
No.
You
that's
don't
the worst,
know it.
That's the worst part about strawberries. They can look beautiful, and they can be completely hard and unripe. Yes, it's true.
It's the predictability. Yes. So understand, we like predictability. We like certainty.
Right.
So we want the strawberry, but are we willing to eat a bad strawberry to find a good strawberry? Or you buy a bunch of strawberries and some of them are good and some of them are bad and they look beautiful,
right,
but they taste terrible.
And maybe a sixth of them are thrown away and that's quite sad.
Yeah, right. Or can I freeze them and put them in a smoothie or figure out some other way that maybe I can hide it so that I have it?
Oh,
but again, a strawberry... It's a strawberry, right? I mean, there's nobody really lying on that package. I mean, it could be organic or not organic, but they didn't really add anything to it.
Right.
But we're taking a risk.
Right.
Right? We're playing Russian roulette to say, hey, did we get a good strawberry? Did we get a bad strawberry, right? So that goes back to, remember my watermelon story, right? So this is the watermelon that I had in North Carolina that was the best
You'll
watermelon.
You'll never forget it.
I'll never forget it. And everything I eat is compared to that. And think about it. I have the idea of what a perfect strawberry
is.
Yes,
same with the peach,
I know what it is.
Right?
Perfect peach.
Yeah.
So I have that in my mind. I know what that is. That's the palatable, right? That's maybe hyper-palatable. It's the liking part.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeking out things to mimic that, right? We want to reproduce that. And it's like, okay, well, does it matter time of year? Does it matter where I buy it? Do I have to buy it from one person versus another person?
I was going to say CSAs are the best for this because it seems like every fruit is delectable.
Yes.
That's
so
definitely.
They're already choosing for you, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
And they're
mm-hmm.
invested in the person that's buying their product because if I give you a crappy strawberry, you're not going to be in my CSA next year.
Right. Or consistently.
I mean,
a bad one here and there, but you're right. They're going to definitely be taste testing and making
and
sure.
And they'll give it to you when it's in season. They're not going to give it
only
to you out of season because right now, can we go buy strawberries at the grocery store?
Only from Cuba or...
Yeah, Chile
yeah.
or
Chile,
wherever,
that's it,
you
yeah.
know. So that's the idea. Like, so we're shipping it how far? And is that good? And when was it picked? And does that make a difference?
And what did they do to preserve it to this point?
Don't know about that. Like, how about those apples that we can still buy Honeycrisp apples now in April?
Right.
Who's picking Honeycrisp apples?
Right.
I think they use nitrogen packing. They're able to preserve it longer, right? They're using ways that they can preserve those apples longer so they don't rot.
But nitrogen isn't bad.
Well, no, but right. So it's another preservative way. That's another way that they're able to preserve that, right? So understand that, again, is that a problem? Is it not a problem? Is salt a problem? Or what are we preserving? We're preserving an apple. We're preserving cod. We're preserving rice noodles. We're preserving chips.
I'm
not sure, right? Maybe that there's more worth in preserving something that's protein-based rather than something that's...
A chip?
Yeah, a chip, a processed carbohydrate that they just process further.
Thank you so much for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. Next month, May 11th, will be the 17th in Paul Rattay's Obstacles to Cure series. It will be Saturday, May 11th from 9 to 10 in the morning at the Commons on Jefferson Street. He's asking for a free will donation. Show up with your questions, and the topic will be choice, the paradox of choice. Does it lead to more freedom?
Ooh.
It's great when you have a cliffhanger. You should always have one of those. I mean, most of them are actually pretty good, but this one's like a question. That's great. Marketing. Yeah. You're telling a story,
yeah,
right?
I'm telling
trying
a story,
to
right?
Reel people in.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so I mean, let's talk about clean label. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And understand, how much do we use the label to make a choice in the grocery store?
A lot. I mean, I do. I for sure do. And I won't forget the citrus now or the Milky Way. Milk protein. That's sad.
So we're dependent upon that label. And understand, we're dependent upon the label. Why are we so dependent upon a label when we go to the grocery store?
Because we didn't make it.
And
it's processed and we know it. So, I mean, why are we looking at the label in the first place? Because it's not a banana.
We want a healthier processed food.
Right. We're trying to do the best we can
in
the middle of the aisles of the
grocery store. And again, we may then make that choice depending on where we shop, right? So then we give trust to the grocery store to say they've vetted out things, right? Whether it's a natural store, whether it's Whole Foods, whether it's Trader Joe's, you know, whatever, that we then say, oh, well, you've kind of been my filter that you're only going to put good products on the shelf.
It's so true, actually, because a local store that has this, they're trying to be more, what's the word I want? They're trying to get their customers to come to them because they're making these choices for them, right? And
yes.
They're saying, please come and shop at our store because we're making these first line choices for you, saying we're not going to buy things that are like this or like that. We're going to buy the best possible, as opposed to going into Whole Foods when you know it's a conglomerate. Right now owned by Amazon, I'm definitely reading every single one of those labels.
Yeah, and then do we care about produce there? So what do we do with produce? Right, so produce doesn't have a label on it.
No.
So now we don't have any quote-unquote processing unless they've stored it somehow. Maybe there's other things that we're not sure about. But again, maybe the goal is to avoid the label. Like if we buy a label, we already know that we're getting something that's of inferior value to something that's fresh along those lines. So is the goal to say, hey, how do we buy foods that don't have labels on them? How do we shop the bulk bin, right? We kind of talked about this. Like what did we do in 1869?
Yeah.
Were there labels on food? There was no legislation. The government didn't say, here's what you got to put on a label. Somehow today we have that, right?
Right, right.
But that we'd go and buy basically it from the bulk bin, right? You'd go to the general store and you'd buy sugar and they'd weigh it out and give it to you. You didn't really question, like, where did that sugar come from?
No.
Or the flour, right?
Because,
the flour.
I mean, we didn't have the infrastructure to be shipping things all over the world at that time anyway, so there wouldn't have been that question.
The local, you know, miller is the one that produced it. So he's producing it, and he's giving it to selling it to the general store,
the
and then they're selling
farm,
it to you.
Providing
right?
the butter.
Yeah, very close-knit that we're within the, you know, geographical range of where that food was produced.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't be eating oranges in Wisconsin.
No, or bananas.
No, they don't grow here.
I mean, you know, in my macrobiotic days, you had a dictum of it has to be within 500 square miles.
Yes.
So if you can find it within 500 miles of where you live, then it's, quote, local, and you can eat it. So, I mean, I raised Aunt Elena. She didn't have a banana until she was like 12. I mean, maybe just last year. She actually doesn't like bananas. But
maybe because she didn't eat them all along, right?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, bananas, I don't know. This is a side note. I've noticed bananas seem to taste like stevia to me. Like, I'm getting this stevia taste from bananas. Not all the time, but it's very weird.
Like, very sweet?
No. It's that stevia sweet thing, right? Mm. But I'm like, it tastes like stevia.
Interesting.
I don't know what that is. I don't like stevia, right? So this is, in my book, not a good thing.
Yeah.
But I've eaten other bananas, but it seems fine. But this is something I've noticed along with Gabriel. Like, do you think this tastes like stevia?
Interesting.
He's like, yeah. And again, not all the time, but I've noticed that, like, there's some difference in that. But maybe that's like eating the strawberry and getting an unripe strawberry, and maybe I'm getting a banana that's not as consistent, right? Maybe there's not so consistent. You know, maybe I need to understand that maybe not all bananas should taste the same way.
Yeah, right.
And but you're playing, you know, Russian roulette with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, those are definitely shipped. In fact, I even lied to Annalena's early kindergarten teachers and said she was allergic to tropical fruit. Oh, my goodness. She said, even in kindergarten, Mom, I was like, what is happening? Because one of her classmates brought a fruit salad and it had tropical fruit, and the assistant went and cut her up an apple and said, your mom would like you to have this. She was like, even in kindergarten, I was like, what the heck is my mom doing now? And it was because I was so strict about everything should be local. Because, and I mean, I was wrong, and we've since laughed about it, and I've apologized, and it's kind of a running joke now. But the point is, you know that when you're buying local, or you don't know, but there's more of a chance that it isn't messed with. Because
yes,
when you're shipping things from so far away, I mean, where do kiwis grow? Do they grow in Minnesota? Do they grow in Wisconsin? So what are they doing in order to keep them fresh enough to even make it to the grocery shelves in Wisconsin? That was my thinking, you know. And again, macrobiotics very much informed me in that way. But, you know, and salt and seaweed were the only exceptions, because we had trade routes as soon as we started trading. What were we trading? Salt and seaweed, things from the sea. You know, we were trading them on land because
that are preserved from just being dried, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
No chemicals involved in there.
Right. Yeah. But you would eat local meat, right? You weren't having seal meat in, you know, Texas or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, there's something to it. There is something to it. Local.
So we avoid the label, but then we still eat bananas. You know, and what level do we make the choice? On what level do we say, hey, I'm going to eat this, I'm not going to eat it? Is it better to eat a banana than it is to eat, you know, Ezekiel bread?
Yeah.
I mean, Ezekiel bread is processed. I mean, it's processed.
It is, yeah.
But I'm going to tell you, that's what I eat. You know, this is what I choose to eat, and it's dense, and you got to chew it, but it's still processed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make it. But they, quote-unquote, use better quality. You know, they sprout the grain, what have you. It's frozen. It doesn't keep as long.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? It's still in a package. I'm not going to make Ezekiel bread. Maybe I should just not eat bread. Yes? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, I think that, you know, naturally leavened bread or sprouted is a good thing. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, even talking about how often we have meals, right? The schools have this snack.
Yes.
Snack is the bane of a parent's existence,
oh my gosh,
in my opinion.
For sure. More eating occasions.
Yes. And the worst part is, you can talk your kid into eating a good breakfast. You can definitely provide a good dinner. You can, you know, outsource the lunch if they're eating it at school. Okay. But this snack, it's always this push-pull with my daughter. I'm like, I really want it to be another healthy, you know, addition to your day. And she's like, come on, Mom, it's, quote, just a snack. But it's once every single day. And
yes,
so I will buy barbecue chips, you know, every 3 or 6 weeks, you know, and I'll say, oh, she hasn't had them in a while. So, right? And I'm not reading the label anymore because I already know that stuff's got sugar in them.
So I've learned this with Gabriel. So this is about, you know, I pack what he packs, and then I see what comes back.
Yes.
And what does he eat and what does he not eat? And I'm very consistent that I know what he's going to eat and what he doesn't eat. And again, how many things or how many, and maybe this is, I haven't really done this with school, but certainly seen that. Like, when is it that he's actually going to eat a can of sardines?
Yeah.
he got to be a little desperate, right? Because if I put cuties in there and I put hummus and I put hummus and I put carrots in there, or I put my, you know, my quote unquote healthy chips, they're not healthy, but you know, this kind of thing that, you know, he's going to always go to them first.
Right.
If I only give him the option of the sardine will get eaten, right? So again, I'm giving him too much choice when I pack his lunch.
Right. Right.
But I don't think that he's going to appreciate going to school and open a can of
sardines.
Right? So I won't
I think
do
that's
that.
That's child abuse.
Yeah, exactly. But if we're not at school, then maybe I do that and then I'm deliberate. Like, oh, all we have is sardines. How hungry are you? Well, I don't want any sardines. Well, maybe you're not that hungry. And maybe you don't need a snack, right? Because again, that snack is another eating occasion.
After school as well,
oh,
right?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The best thing that I think we could do is just, if we did nothing else, eat processed food, what have you, is to say we have 3 30-minute windows a day to eat, and that's it.
Yes.
You got a 30-minute window in the morning, 30-minute window.
Okay, but why can't it be an hour?
Oh,
where we're not actually eating the entire time, but we're talking. And,
okay, that's fine.
Right, okay.
Totally fine.
Because
I
hate these short lunch periods. They drive me crazy, too. I don't feel like they're human.
Yeah,
like we
yeah.
should sit and talk, you know, and chew.
Yeah, so, okay, so let's
right,
just
so
say there's
hours.
3 hours, but
you.
Again, deliberate, right? So there's this
yes.
period of time in between that you can't snack.
Right, right.
There's no eating in between there. You wait until the next meal. I mean, I remember that as a kid.
Oh, my
wait
gosh.
Wait till dinner.
Wait till dinner.
You'll spoil your dinner.
You'll spoil your dinner, right. I mean, and we can say a handful of nuts or whatever, right? There can be some emergency
sure.
backdrop that has to do with something that is, you know, very, very low key as far as spoiling your next meal. Exactly.
Well, are you hangry? And if you're hangry and you say, well, you can't eat, this person's in a lot of trouble if somebody's hangry. What we need to do is get them so they're not hangry.
Let's go back to looking at what they had for the meal.
Exactly. So right. what did they do? How could they eat proactively so they don't get hangry instead of being dependent upon that snack? Or being dependent to say, hey, I can eat something every 2 hours, right? That's the grazing aspect. And I'm going to say grazing is very beneficial with people with reactive hypoglycemia. Because they do that, they prevent going hangry.
Right.
So they eat something so they don't, so their blood glucose doesn't fall.
But
the problem
go.
Is they're constantly eating.
Right.
And probably that they've made better choices or different fuel choices in the morning, more than likely, that then they don't go on that roller coaster that they have to eat 5 times a day.
I know, and this goes back to what do you have for breakfast?
Yes, correct.
And that, you know, back in the day, just like when we would go and get our oats weighed at the local place, right, where the oats were grown in the, you know, the county over, we would also eat leftovers from dinner. I keep trying to tell my daughter this. I'm like, can you just have the rice and beans and veggies and soup that we had for dinner for breakfast? No, Mom. It's got to be what? Carbs. It's got to be oats. I mean, she's very, you know, we don't have cereal or anything
right.
that. But it's not, I'm on a breakfast crusade. Like, how can I get her to eat?
But again, it's in the house, right? So
right.
if it's in the house, it's available. So
yeah.
how do we, but then it's not in the house. If I only have sardines in my house, but I got to take a step back. If you're eating sardines, you may get some heavy metal toxicity. If you're eating who is this? Somebody did that. They were eating 3 cans of sardines a day.
And then
they had some metal.
Toxic.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was cadmium or I'm at a loss at who that was. But again, so that's not the idea, oh, that sardines are the end all be all. But the idea being like, what do you have available to you?
Mm-hmm.
What's in my house? Right? There was some art exhibit somewhere that they said, are our large kitchens making us fat? So they did an actual, you know, exhibit
wow.
on how big the kitchen is today. Or
yeah.
I mean, this is probably 10, 15 years ago compared to what the kitchen was like 100 years ago.
Right. And you know this from old houses. I mean, I guess my house has not been upgraded since its 1925 birth. And I have hardly any space in my kitchen.
Yeah.
That's I mean, if you really want to look at it that way. Yeah, I can only store so much. But of course, I bought IKEA shelves for my dining room, and now that's basically my storage.
What about plates? Would they fit big plates in them when you moved in? Oh, I mean, because I've heard this, that the big plates don't even fit.
I don't know, because I have an island. I have a wheeled island in my kitchen as a result of not having a lot of space. But you're right. Our plates have even gotten bigger over the time. Oh, my gosh, yes. It's so crazy, right?
And what's available to us. We have that availability and we have that food within, you know, we can go in the kitchen and get it at any moment in time.
Right.
And then they get used to it, children,
mm-hmm.
and then that's what they want. Right. So, I mean, I go through this battle with my older boys all the time, right? I'm like, you know, they want chips and they want, I tell a hummus story. I'm sure I told this story. So hummus, right? So hummus, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, like, that's the perfect food, right?
Perfect food.
Well,
okay.
I mean, perfect food, you know, it's beans and it's
protein,
fat, and it's, you know.
Yeah.
And they love hummus, right? So bless their hearts, but they want chips with the hummus, right? And I'd be like, well, you know, and I go in my phases where I'll buy chips and then I won't buy chips and then I'll buy chips. And again, that's not good, right? It's better just to not ever have chips.
Oh, yeah.
And then then during those times, it'd be like, well, I have corn tortillas. You could put them in the toaster oven and turn them into chips. No, I want chips. And so I'm like, well, there's carrots. There's celery,
right?
This is the thing. And funny thing is, if you give me carrots, the choice between carrots and celery, I'll choose carrots every single time.
Oh, me too.
You got to have no carrots for me to eat the celery,
right?
Or peanut butter or something. Maybe that's a better carrier for that. That's curious too. But anyway, so they had that available to them, and they were like, "Oh, we want chips. We don't want to eat anything else." And I knew it was working because they weren't eating it. But they would just, I found the spoon in the hummus one day in the morning.
They're just eating
the hummus by the spoon. I'm like, that's fantastic. I want you to eat the hummus.
Yes.
What you put it on is just the carrier for you to get hummus.
Right.
And we'd rather have that carrier not being negative, right? And
right.
Maybe that there's some positive to eating a carrot or eating celery versus the chip. But
right.
Then it becomes, Ian, you know, and I'll do that too, right? I mean, I'll eat my quote unquote healthy chips. They're not healthy. But, you know, how much hummus can I put on a chip? Oh my gosh, I could put a lot of hummus on a chip
because
I want the hummus. I want the crunch, like the crunch is good.
Yes.
But it's really the hummus. And if it's good hummus, yes, where you got the je ne sais quoi and you got that lemon and you got the garlic and you got the right mix.
It carries itself.
Oh, exactly. So just use a spoon.
Right.
Anyways, that's what my older boys
resorted
to. Or put
it on bread. We used to spread it on bread.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ezekiel bread.
Hey, but let's talk about bread. We mentioned this before, right, about the different kinds of bread. Can you share what we talked about? Remember, we talked about buying the bread local versus buying the bakery.
Oh, yeah. So we buy the local bread that's made fresh all the time. And because we're only a family of two, we freeze half the loaf. So we'll go through the half loaf. And it's a large loaf, too.
It's a bread from Magpie, right? Is it?
Yeah.
It's great bread.
It's excellent bread. Rhythm Bakery is what they're called.
Gabriel can't hear this, right? Because he's gluten-free. So if I eat that, it's got to be when
they don't make
Gabriel's
it gluten-free?
No.
Okay. You could ask them.
Yeah,
I mean, they're young and spry. They could maybe take something new on. Anyway, so we eat half a loaf, and it maybe takes 3 or 4 days to eat that half a loaf. And then I thaw the other half right before the first half is almost gone. And then it takes another 3 or 4 days. And every once in a while, I'll say, should we get like an Alvarado Street bread? Now that's, you know, your local, I mean, not local, it's actually California. But your bagged bread. Now, it is wheat, and I think it's even sprouted, or you can get it sprouted,
yes.
and that's the kind that we buy. And I'll say, do you want to get some Alvarado Street bread? Yeah. It's always this excitement. It's like, do you want to get cereal, right? Which I never say. And so, but when we get this bread, it's gone in 3 days, the entire loaf. All of a sudden, we have to have 2 pieces of toast every morning for breakfast. We might toast some to have with our soup in the evening. We might have a sandwich in the afternoon. This might all happen in the same day even. But the loaf is gone in 3 days, the entire loaf. And it is it's a longer loaf, but smaller pieces. But I mean, it's crazy. And so we just recently did this again, and I go long periods before I buy things like that, like the barbecue chips, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, it might be months, you know? And so I just noticed it again when this loaf went away. And I said, wow, you know, it's obvious that there's obviously dense nutrients that have satiety from the Rhythm Bakery where you just don't go to it the whole time. You're not eating them every single day. But Alvarado Street bread, I mean, I love it anyway, and I'm not saying it's a bad bread,
right.
But it's akin to that sort of, you know, white bread mentality of like, you just eat it. You just eat it all the time. And it's light. It's definitely lighter, and it's fluffier. And yeah, so that's what we noticed about bread is that, you know, there are gradations of...
Right.
Yeah.
And you can't see that on a label, right? So the label does not represent that.
Right.
So this is a nuance, right? And you're a health... I mean, I'm going to put you in the top 3% of eaters.
Oh.
Yeah, for sure. You're the quality of the food that you eat. So, but just knowing that you know
as
all these things.
As much as I annoy Annalena with it, that's why
yeah,
I was
whatever,
surprised. I'm like, but she's so irritated all the time. Mom, I want a snack. And I mean a snack, not healthy.
But she'll thank you later.
Yeah,
28.
Actually, you know what though? Actually, we just had a conversation, and we were talking about the lies about tropical fruit, yeah. and the first birthday party that she was invited to. I think she was 4. It was to Chuck E. Cheese. This is when we lived in Illinois. And we brought our own pizza.
Oh, yeah.
We brought our own pizza. And I'm telling you, even the sauce was not tomato-based. This was hardcore macrobiotic. This was beet and carrot and onion and bay leaf and a little bit of celery. You would pressure cook those vegetables, and then you would blenderize it. And the beet would lend a little sweetness, but also the color of a typical sauce. I mean, that's how strict we were. And the toppings were shiitake mushroom, pepper, and broccoli. Okay, an onion. Anyway, we brought our own pizza. And then one time her friend had a dance recital at the Temple Theater. This was years later. And this is when Dave's Pizza was still open. And I think I even told her then she couldn't get the pizza. She had to get fries. So we were talking about these three monumental moments that she really remembers. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what, honey? I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry that I did that. You know, I was so strict. And if I had known now that you barely go to those outings, that it's not a big deal to do that every once in a while. And she said, and I quote, you know what, Mom, though? I'm really attracted to healthier foods, I think, as a result. I think you did the right thing. She has already said that. I know, right?
Yay! That's so, why we do it.
I was surprised that she said it, because she's 13 and really would appreciate eating more sugar, I think, just because of her hormones and things like that, yeah. Right? But you know, and I'm not as strict. I definitely now, I mean, you know, we've gone to Jumpstart and had birthday parties and eaten other people's cakes and all that kind of thing. But, you know, but she already has recognized that her palate is different. She said, when kids bring me things, you know, and they say, try this, I do, but I'm immediately like, that's not good. And then I recognize too that actually the flavor isn't that great, that I do like more naturally flavored things. So
right. You train the palate. That's our job, right? Help
That's
train
the
their
job.
Palate
and
give
I told
them
her,
varieties of things to try so they know what bitter is, so they know what sour is.
Right. I mean, I just finished, you know, 3 little associate degrees at Western Tech, and I tell you, we have been eating a little bit more openly, you know, some frozen burritos from time to time because I've been doing PowerPoint presentations during college and all of that. And I told her, I said, I know when you go to college, you're going to make choices that are based on convenience and quickness because you're busy and you want to get a good grade and all of that. I said, but I'll know that I've done the foundational work. That's what that was my job, right? That's still my job for another 4 years. But yeah, the foundation needs to be laid for the palate. Anyway, we should go.
All right. That's great. Okay. Fantastic. That's a fantastic story. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. So this has been Obstacles to Cure with the Skeptical Naturopath, Paul Ratay. And Christina DeRocher. Thanks so much for listening to listener-supported WDRT 91.9. We'll see you next month.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Paul. Bye-bye.